Good noon, I guess we can say. Good noon. This is the Conference on World Affairs. We're in UMC East Ballroom, Program 5304, How Music Inspires Me. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CW app. How many people are using the app? Okay. The others can use the note system. Raise your hand if you want a note card. Our producers have note cards and pens. Then when you fill out a legibly written question, they will pick it up and bring it up to me, and I will, and if you're a student, please indicate student. If you're tuned in from elsewhere, please indicate remote or elsewhere and where you're from, and I will note that as well. Make your questions brief and to the point. My name is David Backrack. I have been coming to CWA for 19 years. This is my eighth year moderating. I am sitting in for a slightly injured individual. I told Ernie earlier that when I was about 9 years old, I was exposed to music, first the drums. About 2 weeks later, they said, let's try the trumpet. Then they said chorus, and then they said you can hum, and then they said how about producing? They said to me, you could not backrack, you cannot carry a tune in a suitcase. And I sent a note to my wife this morning. I said they're going to have me produce or moderate the program, How Music Inspires Me, and I got a note back, and she said, please don't sing. So let me introduce our panelists. Their full profiles are in the program and on the app. I'm going to go in order. Rebecca Masterman first worked at the University of Minnesota's B Lab. She's a B girl, B lady. Just imagine Saturday Night Live, John Belushi. That's
awesome.
Yes. As an undergraduate in 1992, she returned to the in 2012 to the B Squad's Associate Program Director Coordinator. Graduated from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, major in history, but minor in biology. And she'll talk a little bit about herself. I didn't have time to do all these. September Penn, a singer-songwriter, recording artist who has performed across the United States, Africa, China, Japan, Israel, Palestine. She's CEO and artistic director and co-founder of The Power of Song, a 501c3 not-for-profit. Po Chi Wu is a Renaissance man. It didn't say that in there, but that's, I mean, listen to this. Innovator, innovation provocateur, educator, venture capitalist, entrepreneur. He advances talented innovators and contributes to healthy ecosystems. Renaissance man. And then, to share a platform with Ernie Watts is like, again, I don't sing, but I sure do love listening to music. Two-time Grammy Award winner, first picked up a saxophone 60 years ago. That must be a typo, at 13. he heard John Coltrane, and the rest is history. And those of you who've been around know Ernie Watts. So we're going to begin with Rebecca.
Thank you. Hello, Boulder. Okay, I actually asked to be last, but he said no, and I'll tell you why. I don't want anybody to walk out of this panel after they hear what I have to say. You have to listen to everybody else because this is where the integrity of the program is. And my connection to music is purely fun, and although I do have a little bit of connection to the program that I run now, at a certain point, both of my parents died, and I created a bucket list, and it was just a bunch of things I wanted to do right away to make sure that I achieved everything I wanted, so the rest is gravy. One of those things was to see the band Tesla. Any Tesla fans? Scorpions? couple of my bands. Okay, come on. Well, now. So then that started my husband and I on a journey, and we started traveling and seeing bands. So we saw the Rolling Stones. They're pretty good. Van Halen. And then my husband said, you know, I really like Metallica. And I said, ugh, okay. And I ended up translating Danish to English and buying tickets to go see Metallica in Denmark 6 months later. So I did this, and I actually became a Legacy Fan Club member in order to get good seats. And then I registered for the tickets. I did it all in Danish. And then I practiced, okay, because I was not a Metallica fan that I knew of, and they were going to play their entire Black album. Does anybody here like Metallica? Thank you. Okay. So I started practicing in the car listening to the CD, and I was like, this is beautiful. This is absolutely beautiful. And that was in 2012. I went to my first concert in the cold, in an old prison in Denmark. They got on stage, and it literally changed my life. And after the concert, I said, Tom, we have to go see Metallica again. And so later that year, we saw Metallica twice in Vancouver. And I've gone back to Denmark to see Metallica, and I think I'm up to 13 concerts. So music, it absolutely, literally transformed my life. And the only connection Metallica has to my beekeeping career is that all of my own personal colonies are named after a Metallica song. So nice. I have Master of Pollination. Pollen load, nectar load. Okay, so that's only going to apply to some of you. But I run a program. Oh, and the other thing is that had I listened to the Black Album in 92, I probably wouldn't have a PhD today, because I probably would have just followed the band. So there's a good thing. But I did get a PhD, and I run a program now where we have a really talented group of individuals and a very diverse group of individuals. I don't just have scientists to teach beekeeping and to teach bee health to the public and to beekeepers, but I have people that I've grabbed from a lot of different disciplines. And the neat thing is that one of the connections that happens within not just our bee squad at the University of Minnesota, but in the bee lab, is we have a lot of musicians. And one of the founding members of the Bee Squad is Two Band Jenny, and Two Band Jenny plays the accordion, and she's also a singer, and she's in an all-female Clash cover band. So we've got a lot of connection to music. I also have a violinist, and the one connection I have to our programming is that we're really trying to have beekeepers monitor a very serious mite pest, and one of the ways that we have done it is we made a series of videos called Making Mite Monitoring Fun. And my employee base is so loyal to me that dear Bridget, who is an excellent violinist, put a veil on, and after I did the test, we have a 2-minute wait period. She learned the Game of Thrones theme song the night before, and she played that in the violin with bees flying all around. You can go see that on, I think it's on YouTube or Facebook. So anyway, we're connecting to our audience. We have programs working with art, and we could try to connect with our audience. And actually, one more, and then I'll stop, is that we've had a composer come and measure the buzzing in a hive and then create an entire work. And there is a documentary, and I can't give it to you right now, but her name is Ray Howell. And she's worked with us and in the greater Minneapolis community. So we welcome those relationships between artists and musicians and the work that we do. But sorry about the Metallica, everybody.
Okay, remember you can submit questions at any time. So we need some. September.
So the saying goes that music calms the savage beast. This session is how music inspires me. I think I came out of the womb singing. I grew up in a family of singers and musicians, and I kind of took it for granted when I was younger, the privilege and the blessing that I have to be exposed to that environment. But what I've learned through the years, you know, just through education, through experience, is that music can completely shift the whole atmosphere of any venue, any situation. Music can calm, music can stir, music can give hope. In my nonprofit, The Power of Song, our flagship production is Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song. And we give, it's like a musical review, and we give history lessons behind the songs that were used in the movement. One radio announcer has dubbed it edutainment because it's educational, but it certainly is great entertainment. By the time the audience leaves, they have learned all of these stories from the artists, like Sam Cooke and A Change is Going to Come. What inspired Sam to write that song? It was the fact that he and his entourage were traveling the segregated South, and once again they were turned away from a whites-only hotel. So at some point he just penned that song. When you look at the lyrics of the song, all of his lament and all of his agony, all of his struggles were in the song. But when you hear the song, it's funky, right? And you dance to it. That's the beauty of music. It will make you dance, but then it will also make you think, what was going on here? What we also do in this production, not only do we give the history of all of the older songs, but we bring it to contemporary context, what's going on today. With music, after you have pleased the audience and these vibrations have gone deep into their very beings, it kind of opens up the space to talk about things that are a little hard to talk about, like police brutality. We can talk about the plight of young black men and what's going on in America. And then we introduce new songs that have been written about this particular situation. That's what you can do with music. Music just kind of opens up the whole atmosphere and makes you ready and available to sit and come to the table and to talk. The weird thing is, even in the middle of our productions, we've gotten testimony has come back that in the middle of scenes, people will turn around and talk to folks on their row. What is she talking about? Because I have a scene about black hair, about corporate America, and how many women in corporate America were having problems with their corporations, saying that their hairstyles were not professional enough. So we introduce a song by India Aubrey, I Am Not My Hair. See, look, here we go. Now that people heard the song, they're bumping, they're dancing, they're enjoying it, and now we can talk about the issue. So people are leaning in, actually, in the middle of the production, what is she talking about? Can you tell me more about this? And they are having real conversations. Music gives you the permission to have some conversation that you would never, ever have. I am such a firm believer in the vibrational frequencies and sending these messages over the vibrational frequencies of music. It's great to sit down and have dialogue and conversation. It's even more beautiful when it goes deeper into you because it rides on the bed of these vibrational frequencies. That's really how music inspires me. That's how I use it in my nonprofit. That's how I use it with even just spreading a table wide to invite people to come to the table to sit. Look for me. I'm working on a project right now, Soul and Social Justice. I've got music that I've been writing over the last 3 or 4 months. It's going to come out. Takes this conversation even further, Soul and Social Justice. These songs that are resonating with what's going on right now in America, that what's going on not just nationwide, but even around the whole world. One more thing. There's a scene that we have in the production about the Japanese internment camp. There's a connection in the civil rights movement with the Japanese internment camp, with Yuri Koshiyama and Malcolm X. So we even share some music that was written in the Japanese internment camp. And it's amazing because when you hear these songs that were written in the camp, they sound so familiar to me and my culture. When you share the music of your culture with another culture, you can see the places of connection. Again, that's the beauty of music and how it inspires me.
Thank you. Thank you, September. Ho-Chi.
I want to start with a very short anecdote that actually builds on what September just mentioned, and it actually involves my son, and I just shared that with Ernie and his wife. In high school, my son went to a private school in the East Coast, and he was a saxophone player, and he joined the performing jazz group. This particular teacher, every 2 years, would take this performing jazz group to South Africa for 3 weeks, and they would visit different schools, local schools, and the children, the students, would play together. And my son, obviously high school age, he said that was life transforming. And it is because music is a universal language. It transcends a lot of things, right? It's not about being ideological. It's not about having the barrier of language. It's really, on a superficial level, it's fun, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a great way to connect. But it certainly can inspire and provoke more thoughtfulness, or even at the very least, engage, right? We can now talk about, oh, what did we just do? What did we just experience? How are other people experiencing their lives? It takes music kind of as a starting point, and then it's not a metaphor, but it's more like a doorway or a gateway to opening up to connect as human beings. So what I had originally planned to talk about was to tell you just a very brief outline of my personal history, my personal growth, and how music has been a continuing theme in that. And it's really, I hope you'll find it interesting. So they added me to this panel just 2 days ago and said, oh, you know, someone was unable or ill, and could you fill in? And I responded by email. I said, yes, I'd be delighted, because music is at the core of my soul. So the story goes this way. I am a pianist, classically trained, and I started about six. I was musical, but not a particular prodigy. But somewhere maybe 3 years in or something, I used to like to practice. I was an only child, but I used to like to practice the piano after my parents had gone to bed. I was kind of self-conscious. And so 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, everything is still, right? I mean, any of you who have had this opportunity to learn an instrument know that in the beginning, it's kind of you feel self-conscious. And there's something about the stillness of the night. And this particular time, obviously, I remember it very well. I was playing, I think it was a Chopin Nocturne, some Chopin Nocturnes. These are not terribly complicated, advanced kinds of technical things. But at some point, I suddenly feel like I'm not doing the playing. The music is just flowing out, and it's unimaginably better than I could remember I could do. And I was just almost like, you know, looking at it. And so I think of that as my first spiritual experience. I was not raised in a religion, so I don't have that particular kind of background. Always interested in these matters. But this was the first real spiritual experience, meaning kind of out of body or beyond my physical understanding. So I continued to learn to play the piano, again, not terribly well. I actually had a double major in university, carrying both music and mathematics. I went to UC Berkeley, it's not performance, general music. The first 2 years of learning musicianship, the toughest 2 years of my life, really, really tough for me to learn how to hear better and pay attention to the kinds of things Ernie does so extraordinarily well, rhythm. I'm still learning much more about how important rhythm is. It's because it's the rhythm of life. And then I'm going to fast forward to after I finished my PhD. Again, I was an only child. My mother had a terminal illness. I thought might last 2 or 3 years, something like that. And I was still several years younger than my peers. And that's a different story. So I talked to my parents. I said, I'd really like to spend this time. I will take care of Mom. My father was working somewhere remotely. I want to take care of Mom. I was always close to her. But I want to spend this time really seriously playing the piano. So I committed to practicing like 8 hours a day. And I also set myself the goal of entering piano competitions in Europe. Now, I had no illusions that I was that type of capability. I was not interested in that career. But I felt I needed to set myself an impossible goal to see what could come of that. It turned out to be, for myself, again, a transformative experience. And then ever after that, I'm going to finish up here. Ever after that, I find that every time I play pieces, old pieces that I'm familiar with, the way I play, what I hear, is that the music is a way for me to measure my growth. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of connecting with other people, which of course is incredibly important, but it is a way for me to see, I've actually matured. I've actually learned some things. I'm actually hearing things in a different way, in a clearer, more comprehensive way. And, you know, jazz is the next step here that I need to learn something about.
Thank you, Pochi. Ernie Watts. And questions, please. Send questions. I've got a few.
Are we doing questions or me?
No. You're...
Okay. I started playing music when I was 13 in school. as part of the music program in my junior high school. I didn't know if I wanted to play the saxophone or any musical instrument. I was with a friend of mine, and he wanted to go to the music department and get an instrument. So I figured I was hanging out with him. I'd go see if they had a trombone, because I must have seen the Glenn Miller story or something like that on TV the week before. So we went down to the music department, and we got this, my friend got a tenor saxophone. The school was all out of trombones, so I was given a baritone saxophone because I was tall for my age, and the teacher figured I could carry it in marching band. So I had this baritone saxophone that I was carrying back and forth to school every day with my books in one arm and this baritone saxophone in my other arm. About 4 months later, the school got an alto saxophone. And the teacher noticed that my right arm was about 3 inches longer than my left arm from carrying the baritone back and forth to school. So he let me borrow and learn the alto saxophone. We had no jazz program at our school, so I studied classical saxophone. I studied with the teacher at the school, and then I started taking private lessons. So I learned the saxophone technically, what we would call technically correct, right? I learned how to play the notes in tune. I learned how to read music and all of those things dealing with classical music. I started to play jazz by ear because my mom, who was very supportive, but I don't come from a musical family except some relatives, distant relatives. And so my mother realized I wasn't going to quit because I would go to the room myself and practice every day. So she figured that she would join the Columbia Record Club and get myself a record player. So I grew up out of the Sears Roebuck catalog, right? Now, the Sears Roebuck catalog had this, it was an incredible thing. They had music stuff, they had everything. So their music department was called Silvertone. So she bought this little Silvertone stereo record player. It was stereo because you take the front off of it and set the speaker over about 4 feet, so that made a stereo. One speaker here, one speaker there. So she did that, and then she joined the Columbia Record Club. Now, when you join the Columbia Record Club, the first record you get is a freebie. That was a freebie. So the freebie that year was a Miles Davis album called Kinda Blue, which has become the most famous jazz record that was ever made. It was just chronologically at the right time with the right feeling. In this music, there was a change going on in music from bebop to modal music, from very densely harmonic music like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, people like that, to modal music where there was one chord for maybe 8 bars, 12 bars at a time. So it opened up the harmony. Kinda Blue sort of was the most illustrious illustration of that kind of playing. On that album, well, there was Miles Davis, of course. There was a wonderful piano player named Bill Evans. There was Paul Chambers, who was a great bass player that played on just about everything Miles Davis did at that period of time. And Cannonball Adderley, who was one of the great alto saxophonists of all time. Wynton Kelly also, which is another piano player. There were two piano players on this. And there was a tenor saxophone player named John Coltrane. When I heard John Coltrane, it was like I stuck my finger in a light socket. It was like nothing I ever heard in my life, and it totally transfixed me. I mean, I tell people it rearranged my chromosomes. Right. So from that point on, with my 14-year-old mind, no harmonic knowledge, no concept of improvisation, it sounded very simply, like everybody had a particular vocabulary that they played. Musicians have a vocabulary, a sound, connections of notes and lines to make phrases that come from various places. Most of the time from memorizing what other people did before them, and they put it together. Right, a little bit of a line here, a little bit of a line there, something that somebody played that you like, and you learned that. And these little sprinkles of lines are what musicians call licks, little phrases, little sentences. When I heard Coltrane played, he played in a totally different way. And so to my 14-year-old mind, it sounded like he was playing in another key, but it worked. Right. So from that point on, I wanted to play in the other key. So my life has been sort of devoted to learning how to play in the other key. You know, so as I went along and studied and learned, I learned about harmony, I learned about chord scales. I learned that there's a scale for every chord. If you learn all the scales for all the chords, it's impossible to make a mistake. So then improvisation becomes an elaborate game of multiple choice. Right? So I learned about that just from evolving information. Then at a certain point, you know, when you're a young kid, you always want to be the best. You always want to play first seat. This is America. Everything's a football game. Right? Everything's a contest. Everything's a football game. If you're not first, you're not nothing. Right? So, from that, I had to grow through that. You know, I was about 36 years old by the time I got through that. You know, passing through our culture, evolving beyond our culture, the game. Then I started to study music inwardly, and you find out that what we do and the way we think and the values that we have come from very, very ancient laws and rules. It goes all the way back to Greece. It goes back to Pythagoras. He's the first guy that separated the octave into eight notes and did it with a piece of string. Very old stuff. Greek philosophy and psychology was very, very rooted in music. Indian philosophy, Indian history is very deeply rooted into music, and it's rooted into music through vibration. The universal source is vibration. Everything is vibration. So everything is vibration at various velocities, right? We're on the third dimensional plane now. That's one of the slower velocities. As velocity of vibration speeds up, our reality speeds up. That's why we have a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh dimension. It's the velocity of vibration. What you find out from studying music is it puts you in to communication with the various velocities of vibration. So, therefore, music and the basis of music is the basis, I believe, and from what I've studied, it's the basis of universal reality, right? In the beginning was the word was a sound, the word was a concept, an idea, it was a vibration. Everything starts with vibration, and then it is just velocity of vibration that speeds up. Music was always at the top as far as ritual, as far as all social gatherings. In the church before then, the mystery schools, all of the things that came before Christianity, music was very, very strong. Mainly because what it did was, and what it does now, and the purpose of it, is to take our consciousness to another level. Music takes our consciousness to another level because it takes us out of the verbal format into the vibrational format. If you hear a song and you hear blues and you hear Sam Cooke and he says, oh, you know, I got the blues and I feel so bad I could jump out of the window, he's telling you what to think, okay, and you say, yeah, I feel bad too, and I got the blues and I'm going to jump out of the window. But if you hear somebody play and there's no words, then you make up your own story. When you hear music, when you hear the vibration, when you open up to vibration, you feel what you have personally that is generated by this vibration. So, in the music of John Coltrane, in the music of these other, of several other people, they recognize that too, and they spent their lives getting in touch with this deeper vibration, which is the root of, you know, of our music and our consciousness and the way we think and our values. So we'll talk about this some more. I think I've hit 5 minutes. Thank you.
Professor Ernie Watts. So I'm going to pose a question to the panel and let them respond. I've got a bunch of good questions. We'll take more. We're going to have some room. So I work in healthcare, and when I was at MD Anderson, we instituted something called Art Cart, where a patient could choose a painting or a reproduction for their room. Very often they had long lengths of stay. We then introduced music. Because we came to appreciate that music has wonderful healing properties. Someone donated a Baldwin grand piano to the lobby, and we had volunteers come and play. Can you talk a little bit, each of you, just briefly, about music as a healing mechanism?
Well, music as... I'll go. Music as a healing mechanism goes back to ancient history. It was always used as a healing mechanism. We're talking about vibration again. The thing that people don't realize is everything is vibrating. Every cell of your body is vibrating. You communicate through that, and you communicate with yourself through that. Did you know you can talk to your cells? And if you don't feel good, and if something is if something's not right with you, doesn't feel right with you, you can direct your energy towards those particular cells for that particular organ, and you can feel better. Okay? The ancients recognized that. So in using music as that vibration to heal, that is what he's mentioning for this. So that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, and then also, just to add to that, there have been studies with Alzheimer's patients, you know, patients with brain injuries. I remember seeing this video on one particular patient. He had become basically mute, non-communicable at all. But his daughter brought a mix, a CD mix of all of his old songs that he used to listen to. He's probably in his 80s. They put this music on his... He's totally not relating to anybody, but once they put that music on the earphones in his ear, he starts singing along with it. He starts tapping his feet, and the nurses are like, he hasn't been doing this. He's kind of just been in the corner, completely isolated. The music completely woke him up. And even after, I mean, he must have listened to it for about 30 minutes. Afterwards, he was able to communicate. He talked about the music is romance. We need more romance. All of this is coming out of this man after weeks and weeks of just struggling to just articulate anything, any type of thought. So they're using music as a part of brain therapy for Alzheimer's patients. Just as Ernie says, literally, you can take music. Music, what it does to the heart itself, this beating organ within us, It is such a healing energy. I'm so glad he piggybacked on the whole vibrational thing, because I'm such a firm believer of the vibrations that go across, not just talking. But if we sing, it just goes deeper. It always goes deeper into ourselves. It's like a weird entryway into this part of our very beings, just waiting to receive it. Yeah. There is such so much healing therapy that can take place through music.
I want to speak to the ancient cultures, such as in China, Tibet, India, and so on. And I think, of course, North American Indians as well. So Ernie may be able to correct me, but thinking about this, music, and certainly rhythm in the sense of sort of drumming, must have predated any kind of language, right?
Well, as far as we can figure it out, music was the first language, right? Og and Oog, they were there in the tribe and out there wherever the beginning of everything was. And the first thing that happened was it was Oog. And then the other guy said, Oog. You know, and Oog. Oog. Okay, so language began and music began that way too. You know, somebody banged a log with another log, and there was a sound, and another guy banged two rocks together, and there was another sound, and that's how these things were born. Somebody blew on a reed of grass and made the first wind instrument, and all of these things came together to create music, and at that time, that was believed to be magic. And so people began to deal with those sounds as spirits, as beings. And so that's how those things began. Everywhere, globally, that's the history of man.
Right. So it's not just communication from sort of individual to individual, but it's very much a social organization. It was a tool for getting people together.
Right.
And it is exactly the common sense, the physical sense of this vibration that gets shared, and that does something to your brain. So there are wonderful modalities. In fact, just recently, last couple of years, I had what they call a gong session. So these, you know, large metal gongs. And this was in Hong Kong. It was an American expat who has been studying this for a dozen years or so. And she's dedicated her life to this, that in fact, this type of gong, both the treatment or playing, has healing properties. And I can personally attest that that is my experience. So those are very ancient. And many of you probably know Tibetan bowls, also metal. And you use a rod and you make this sound. And those things are, you know, they're built into the earth. They're built into the metal. And there's something that humans need to respond to the earth. And the best way is actually through sound, because it is about vibration. We are vibration. This is what quantum physics tells us. But our sensation actually, in this sense, predates our cognitive function. And that's even more so why it is so powerful.
They used to play gong with the wind.
Oh.
Right? Oh.
Gong.
Jump in.
Okay. I'm just going to add briefly to it. I came from a non-musical family, but lost my father to dementia. And he'd lost the ability to speak, and nobody in our family has the ability to sing. But once he really wasn't able to recognize anything, we ended up moving him to a memory care unit. And the only thing Dad and I did walking in around in circles around that unit was sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," because that's the music he loved at the ballpark, and he loved the ballpark. And so that I think it connected to him when he was so far gone. And then I don't sing, but I sang that song with my dad every chance I got, and I love that it connected to me too. So it heals those who maybe aren't sick but just hurt.
Great. I want to add just one more extension, a very short one, which is that there are serious studies about how music can enhance learning. You know, not only in children, but in adults. And it is also helpful for people who are doing other kinds of tasks, that we can perform them better. And in fact, computer programming, software programming, many employers actually look for students who studied music, either formally or some way, because they turn out to be better at writing software programs.
great. Okay, now I have some questions. I got a note from my daughter because we're linked together, and she said, not only don't sing, please don't dance. So this is one for Rebecca. Do bees react differently to different styles of music? That's part one. Now, part two is, and what's your position on Iron Maiden? But let's go with the part one.
Okay. So part one. I think beekeepers react to the music. I know beekeepers do, not the bees. Bees do react to vibrations, but they react more to the lawnmower vibrating the ground in front of them instead of the Metallica being played in the apiary. A couple of years ago, when Prince died, we were tasked at the same day to put a lot of new colonies into hives. And in the Twin Cities, there were more than one station that was just playing nonstop Prince music. And so it's another way, I guess, that music can heal. But the bees, they care a lot less about what we're playing than what we do. So never seen Iron Maiden. I actually had tickets. I think I was sick and my husband took a friend. But they're good. They're really good. But they're not Metallica.
Okay, now here's a question. Brief answers from each of you. Can you speculate about what music inspires Donald Trump?
Are we allowed to do that?
Oh, God.
Assuming he's inspired.
Yeah.
Anybody want to take that? Why don't we come back to that one? Okay. Here's a student. I only read the questions.
That was troublemaking.
Actually, I want to offer something, and it's only half seriously. If he could sing, which he probably can't, he would probably want to sing Frank Sinatra's I Did It My Way.
Clearly. How would you say music influences and impacts culture and pop culture? So that's a kind of deep one, too.
Well, you can skip me and go right to the experts.
Okay. September, this is for you.
Music influences culture and pop culture. Is it a particular style of music or just music in general?
I just read the question.
I think music shapes just about everything, honestly. I think music, because of the frequencies, and I would like to say good music, but sometimes it's not good music. Sometimes it is just kind of whatever, you know. But even that's shaping the culture in some way. When it's really good music, I think it helps to create a more conducive atmosphere for community, for raising the frequency. I think the more good music we put out there, the higher the frequency is raised in general. Prayerfully, of the whole freaking nation. I mean, I'm at this place now. We all need to just be putting out more and more good music because we need it. There's so much negativity that's in the atmosphere. There's so much contention. There's so much. Too many teams are coming up. I'm on this side. I'm on that side. And what music does do is it brings people together. Whether you're, Republican, Democrat, Black, White, whatever your race is, what I've found with music, it's like a unifying factor. It cuts across all boards. It brings people together. And that's not even just, if you're talking about this culture or just across the universe. I've done work in Japan, and when I'm singing in English. They have this love for Black gospel music in Japan. It started with Sister Act. So they have, I know, can you believe it? There are Black gospel choirs all over Japan. Yeah, all over, and they are learning the Black gospel technique. Go figure. So I go there, and I'm singing in English, Black gospel songs. Many of them speak English, but many of the older ones, I'll share one story. There was an older Japanese woman, probably in her 70s or early 80s. And the way she came after the concert and how she approached me, because in their culture, they don't emote. So what black gospel music does is it frees them up to emote. But even still, she's trying to restrain herself, trying to stay within her particular culture. She's approaching me, and she's like shaking. And I have a translator with me. I was like, what's going on? And she's like shaking her head, and she's trying to fight back the tears. And I'm asking, why can't you cry? Is it because of your culture? She's like, And I said, you know what? It's okay to cry with me. And that's translated. And so she actually lets herself cry. I ask permission to hug her. She comes in, and I'm holding the 70-year-old Japanese woman who was weeping in my arms because of the cross-cultural experience and connection. It's the vibrations. I hope she thought I sounded great, but it's the vibrations. That's what did the work and touched her and freed her up and allowed her to emote. So your music definitely can change and shift any culture. It's the music, baby. It's the music. Yeah.
Okay, so just briefly, obviously it is a means of communication, of connection. In every generation, whether you think of generation in chronological age or any other form, is going to want to express themselves in their unique way, right? They have to find their own voice, whether it's literally voice or instrumental voice. And I think that's part of it, right? You always want to do something not too terribly different or sometimes radically different, but that's the point. It is a personal expression, and if it connects with other people, then you can start a movement.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the level of good music and bad music.
That's right.
Okay? If you like it, it's good music. If you don't like it, it's bad music. Thank you.
So that goes to a student's question. In terms of inspiration, the musical work of singer R. Kelly is potentially inspiring. Mm. I let something fly. I'm not sure what that is. Is that correct?
Is the question, is his music inspiring?
I think so. He says it's potentially, he or she, potentially, he, because it's handwriting like mine, potentially inspiring. Example, I let the something I... can fly.
Oh, yeah, I believe I can fly.
Oh, I believe I can.
I know what you're talking about. I know. That whole story with R. Kelly is sad. It's a fiasco. That particular song can be potentially inspiring, certainly. But, and this is my personal opinion. I'm not putting this or giving a solid answer. When I hear R. Kelly's music, whether it's that song, which may be potentially inspiring, or any other song, because I know the story of the victims, because I know, his history of being a pedophile, I get slightly grossed out. That's just me personally. Now, when it first comes on, I'll be honest, not that exact song, but other songs, when it comes on, you're moving to the beat. It feels good. But for me, because I know the history of it, the reminder, it causes me to kind of like, maybe that's not a solid answer. But we actually had this discussion yesterday in the panel, When Heroes Fall, how can we separate the art from the artist? When we know that this particular artist has committed a crime, has completely fallen, has done something, detriment to society. That's a difficult thing to do. But depending on what the crime is, and also depending on if the artist has actually confessed, asked for forgiveness, tried to reckon with what's going on, it is difficult to separate from the art from the artist. And again, that is going to be a personal evaluation.
Some people are really injured, and their music and what they do is the light part of what they are, And when they put down their instrument or they step off of the stage, then a lot of times they go back into this other darker area. A lot of us are injured, you know, and so the music saves us for the amount of time that we're doing it, but we can't hold on to that vibration when we come back to the world. You know, I tell people, well, you know, when I put my instrument away, I'm just another guy standing in line at the market. And a lot of people can't, a lot of people have a problem dealing with that. Music will take you to such a level that it can be very difficult to deal on a pragmatic plane. And that's what happens to a lot of people. Sorry I interrupted.
No problem. I think as a consumer of music, I have kind of a unique ability to go, and we can go to different bands, and you read about the band, and you're like, holy cow, their politics are very different than mine, or wow, they've made some decisions in life that I might not agree with. And for me, it kind of builds on what Ernie just said, is that there's the art that I can absolutely appreciate, and then I actually allow myself the crime is one thing, but if it's a different of opinions or lifestyles or beliefs, I allow myself to divorce the art from who that human right. being is and still embrace the art. There's a lot of work out there that was fueled probably by some drugs and alcohol, and the kind of the cool thing that I experience now is that a lot of these bands that we go to are like 100% sober, mm-hmm. older with families, and so darn good. And the master class that I was able to observe, I heard the lesson that the practice that goes in over and over and over again to that art, that it creates this peace, and that's for us to enjoy. But sometimes we have to divorce ourselves from the judgment, I think.
Right. Yeah, when you see someone like Mick Jagger at 75 performing, I mean, that's an athlete. That's not just a musician. You know. So there are a number of questions. I'm going to kind of blend these about inspiration. What inspires you? And one question, part of it was, can you listen to music or play music when you're depressed or hurt? And it kind of goes to Ernie's comment. Please talk about inspirations for composing music. Does it come in different ways and at different moments? And one person says, I saw Jimi Hendrix movie Electric Church last night. Found it interesting that rather engaged in civil rights in Vietnam, the Vietnam War issues, he looked at his performances as opportunities to gather people together in love, mm-hmm. hence the use of the word church, a gathering of people. So inspiration, what moves you, and where does music intersect?
I'd like to start with the idea, can you make music when you're depressed? And it's actually your earlier question about how music heals. I think we, those of us who can, are privileged enough to perform at whatever level, actually, even if you can't really carry a tune very well, it is a form of self-healing, right? It's the vibration that you create in your body through perhaps physical performing, certainly with singing, because that's really literally in your gut, or even listening. So it is both a way of expressing your feelings. So if you're depressed or frustrated, well, my wife always tells me that. She knows what mood I'm in by how I'm playing my pieces. So it's part outlet, it's part healing. It's also just a way of reconnecting with myself, even if no one else is listening. And that's a very important part. You know, I have to make music for myself first. Mm-hmm.
That's called the blues. And every culture, universally, has some form of blues. People feel sad, people feel oppressed, and this sound comes out. And every culture on this planet has some form of the blues, because every culture on this planet has some form of sadness, some form of depression. So we call it the blues.
September.
I mean, some of the very best music has been born out of suffering, has been born out of pain. Whether it's, you know, the pain of the artists or the situation collectively, and this music has lasted, you know. I want to kind of touch on your second one was inspiration as far as composing music. For me, it kind of drops. I don't have the ability to just sit, okay, I'm going to write a song today. I wish I did. I remember at one point, when people ask you to introduce yourself, my thing was, I'm a singer-songwriter. And at one point, I started questioning, am I still a songwriter? I haven't written a song in about 2 years or 3 years. Can I still say I'm a songwriter? And it's like, I said, yeah, you're still a songwriter. You just relax. Just be that. Yeah, for real. And I was like, okay, I guess I still am. But then, for me, it falls. It's like I have to have energy is clear, you know, all hearts and minds are clear. I'm in a place where I'm available to receive it. You know, if I, when I say like things being clear, sometimes if things are clogged up, say I need to forgive somebody or I need to ask somebody for forgiveness, I get things right in the atmosphere. Sometimes for me that's a hang up. But once I get that cleared up, I'm available to receive it. One of the last songs that I wrote, I actually wrote really, really quickly. It was just like dropping immediately on a trip. I was in a museum with one of my mentors. And as he was describing this exhibit, it's about kintsugi. We were in Japan and we were talking about the art of the old Japanese art form of kintsugi, where you take broken pottery and it's put back together with gold. So that makes the ending product is more valuable than it was even before it was broken. So hence he's describing this whole process. I start hearing little bits of a song just fall. So for me, that's kind of how my writing process has been. I get myself in a place where I'm available to receive it, and then I just kind of quickly write as it's falling. Yeah, and then the tune usually comes right with it. Sometimes I have to wait for maybe the verse for a little bit later, but I'll catch that first part pretty easily. I'd love to hear your writing process, Mr. Ernie.
That's a divine gift, right? That's the way. You have to be in the right framework for that.
I'm a practice freak. So practicing and playing and staying in touch with my instrument is a very, very, very strong part of my life. That's the way I build my day. I get up in the morning, I meditate, I go and I practice, and then I let the world in. Then I let the world in. When I practice, it's like a meditation. I have certain things I do in a certain way every day because I'm a human being and I'm 73 years old and I've got all these little muscles and all these little nerves that I have to keep functioning in order for me to do what I do effortlessly. So I have particular physical things I have to do every day. Then I start working on tunes, scales, and as I work on harmony and scales and patterns, tunes come through. Sometimes it's a whole song, sometimes it's a 4-bar piece that I'll leave and I'll do something else and come back to. Sometimes it takes a day to write a tune, sometimes I write a tune over a period of time, but it usually comes from my instrument. I'm playing my instrument, I'm hearing things, so what's happening with me, because the saxophone is a melodic instrument, it's coming from the top down. It's coming from the melody, then I will hear bass function, and then I will work on the inner harmonies. I'm a terrible piano player. When I was at Berkeley, all I did was practice and practice the saxophone. So then I got the job with Buddy Rich's band, and I left school and I joined Buddy Rich. And my good friend Alan Broadbent, who's a wonderful, wonderful piano player, the last thing he said to me was, Ernie, you shouldn't go out on the road. You should stay and get your piano harmony together. So I didn't do that. I went out on the road. So when I write basically melody, basic harmony, and the bass process, the function, the basic key, the way it moves, the way it feels. Then I get with somebody that can play the piano. Right? Because if you know about anything about harmony, the guitar, the piano, or anything else, you can have a set of chords, and there's seven different ways to play them. You can write a basic set of harmony, and there's like 10 ways to play them. So if you get to with somebody that's been playing the piano for 40 years, they're going to hear some other stuff. You know, and then they can just go, well, hey, da-da-da-da-da, you like that? Or da-da-da-da-da, you like that? And it would take me half an hour to go, da-da-da-da, there's a B-flat, da, you know. So most of what I write is from the top down, and then I fill in the middle. So that's the way I write. It comes from my horn. It comes from practicing.
So we have about 10 minutes where... Now I've got more questions than we're going to get to, so I'm going to combine a couple. I want to talk about emotion and imprinting. I'm going to read a couple. I'm not black. Why does Eye of the Sparrow make me cry? That's part. If the same piece of music is played by two groups, both technically correct, why does one group's playing touch the soul and the other does not? And student, for me, I use music to encapsulate certain experiences in my life. I consciously engrave memories and emotions into particular songs. Is this something you experience as well?
Mm-hmm. You want to go first?
No. For the first part of the question, we go back to the beginning, which is music is energy, it's vibration. And when somebody hears something or you feel something and it brings that emotion to you, it's because it's striking a common tone in your heart. When I was first beginning to play, I would hear certain things that jazz musicians play. There's going back to Kind of Blue, there's a composition called Blue and Green that Bill Evans wrote. It's a 10-bar tune. It's only 10 bars. It's a very short thing. John Coltrane played a solo that was so beautiful, when I was 14 years old, I cried. When I listened to certain aspects of Stravinsky, I cried. When I listened to the Emperor Concerto by Beethoven, the second movement, the Adagio movement, I cried. I don't know why, because it struck that common tone within me. It wasn't about being black, it wasn't about being white, it was about a feeling. And that's what this music is, and that's what this music, that's the purpose of this music. That's the purpose of music. The purpose of music is to touch your heart. The purpose of music is to remind you where you come from. The purpose of music is to remind you that you can go home.
Don't want to add too much to that, but yeah, it's soul to soul. That particular song, His Eyes on the Sparrow, Why Do I Feel Discouraged? It is speaking to a familiar place. All of us in humanity at some points, we get discouraged. And this song, it's timeless. It will forever be timeless. And then the second part of that question, as far as one group being technically right and the other group actually touching and penetrating, that has to do with, I believe that has to do with the intent of the artist. I said earlier, you know, I don't know if I said in this panel or another panel, but artists are antenna. So from the group that's playing it technically right, Maybe their intent is to just play it perfectly. We're going to play every note perfectly. We're going to get the timing perfectly. And maybe with the second group, they are really connecting on a more spiritual, more passionate, a place that's beyond just the technique of it, but just the heart-to-heart. They're just playing with their souls. I used to serve in a group with a gentleman who played the flute, and technically he was always on, correct. And our music minister said to this gentleman, "You sound great, but another 4 or 5 years, you're going to sound mature, like you've been through something. When you've experienced certain things in life, when you sing this song, maybe it's not perfectly or technically correct, but because you are seasoned and you're experienced and you really want to minister hope and love and truth, that's what comes out. That's why it causes, that's why it moves and causes the tears, because it's beyond just being technically right. You want to minister love."
And that happens to us as performers. Sometimes I play and I'm thinking about playing it technically perfect. And so that's what comes through. Sometimes I'm playing and I think of my mother.
Yeah.
Or somebody I loved. And it feels like they're playing it through me.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I'm communicating with my mother. Or my friends that passed away, or somebody that I knew that played this tune. And I'm playing this tune because I remembered them playing it. And so it gives the music a whole other source, you know. It taps you into the universal voice, because all of these spirits, all of these sounds, they're still there, you know. There's still, people believe that, you know, the music goes up, but it doesn't go away. And it's the same with the spirit, right? We go away, you know, we trade in our Chevy and we go away. The machine is gone. But what the machine is not gone. And when you play music and when you're in a certain mood, even if you're not in a certain mood, I mean, some things are just transfixing. And I can't, you know, I'm not supposed to be able to explain it, because we're talking about something that's ineffable. And we all know what that means. But that's why when you hear a group and it's all sparkly, twinkly, clean, and you say, "Yeah, that's great, they played every note, but it didn't mean anything to me." When you hear somebody else and it makes you cry, it's because they're touching that common bond. We're all connected. We're all a part of the same energy. There is a common bond between all of us, and every now and then we touch that, or it touches us.
We've got less than 2 minutes.
I'd like to add one short thing. I'll take 1 minute. And that's the difference between playing the piano, where all the keys automatically, you know, you press a key, you get a particular frequency, and what these two performers do, which is you sing, right? It comes from your body. And I've always marveled how the great artists, great pianists, have such unique sound, such a unique characteristic when they play the piano. And that's just, I just want to throw that out for your reflection, because the piano seems to be very mechanical. How can you actually affect the tone of the sound? But obviously you can. It's very different, in a very different way though, than when you sing or play a wind instrument or even a violin.
And I'm just going to quickly add, we've been talking about hearing music, but there's also seeing music. And so for me, the emotional part of it is watching those artists communicate through their instruments, via instruments or voice.
As we saw in the concert the other night. So last question, 20 seconds each. Les, please. What is the most inspirational song in your life, now and in the past? Go. I wanted to ask this to you earlier to think about, but
oh.
All right, I'll start. For example, the famous part of the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, right? Everyone knows that one, the Ode to Joy.
This was one that was actually already mentioned, but I think it would be His Eyes on the Sparrow. And I know I'm going too long. I breathe and think. I'm feeling all this stuff. I'm like, what are you going to give? But yeah, His Eyes on the Sparrow. And for me, I've looked at it freshly over the last year, because I'm not just looking at God as the He, but when I think of even her eyes on the sparrow, and I know that she watches me, that does something for me. Yeah. The motherhood of God.
Mine would be Wayfaring Stranger. And that's because I have a personal connection with it, right? My friend Charlie Hayden, who is a great, great bass player, grew up in the Ozarks. He grew up in country music. He was in a family that had a radio show every day. He was a singer. He was like 3 years old. He was a singer. He got polio. He couldn't sing anymore. One of his vocal cords went. That's how he learned to play the bass. He became one of the world's great bass players with Ornette Coleman and anybody else you can think of. And before he died, he sang again. And he sang that tune.
Wow.
So it's a very, you know, it means a lot to me.
Rebecca.
Master of Puppets, Metallica. They were kids when they wrote it. It is a genius piece of music. And if you have ever been in an auditorium with them and 30,000 other people who are all coming together from different backgrounds, and they can bring people together with that song.
Thank you all. Thank our panel.